Hi there, and welcome to Be Your Own Healer Telesummit. I'm Jonathan Fitzgordon, creator of the Core Walking Program, and today I'll be talking to Brooke Thomas, author of The Liberated Body Guides, whose first ebook, Why Fashion Matters, is a must-read. Brooke has been a certified Rolfer since 2000, and more recently has become a yoga tune-up teacher studying with Jill Miller, who will also be part of this telesummit. Brooke and I go back almost 10 years, and I remember vividly our conversation about doing trade and sharing each other's work. It was exciting to be connecting and our shared commitments to helping people and helping people heal. Plus, we became clients for each other. The Rolfing 10 series I did with Brooke was a life-changing experience, and Brooke was also one of the first clients of the Core Walking Program. I personally learned so much from those early experiences. So, Brooke, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
You were one of the first people I thought of when we planned this project. Over the years, we've bonded over our work and how much we enjoy helping people, while at the same time, it's been great to recognize how important it is for people to help themselves. I'd just love to start by asking you, what does Be Your Own Healer mean to you, and why is it important for people to heal themselves?
Well, to me, I mean, I think, first of all, the Be Your Own Healer phrase can maybe be taken in a way where it's like we have to be, we're Americans, right, so we can do it in this, like, self-flagellating way where it's like I have to be able to fix myself. But to me, what it means is that you're able to know yourself, to have systems and methods and tools where you can kind of get inside your own skin and inside your own self and listen to your intuition and be able to build the most appropriate toolkit, whether it's self-care toolkit or figuring out what practitioners are going to help you most. And I'm definitely an advocate of having both. I think it's important to have both. And I really think that that's the path to getting well from anything, that we need to be able to follow our own lead, know ourselves well enough that we can do that effectively.
You know, I know a little bit of your backstory, but how has your personal history informed your approach to working with people currently?
Yeah, I mean, my personal history, like a lot of us who are in these fields, these helper fields, it's the reason why I do what I do. I had a birth injury when I was born, so I had a cord strangulation that just kind of kinked my upper cervicals. Atlas and axis were kind of side bent on each other, and that meant that I grew up with a jaw growing displaced and chronic pain, and I also had some neurological issues and mobility issues growing up. And because I had neurological issues, seizures in my case, petit mal seizures, I had a lot of neurologists in my life as a kid, and they really weren't interested in hearing about the chronic pain that I was dealing with because they were trying to manage my seizures, and that was their job. And I also think there's this bias where people don't believe that kids experience chronic pain. And so it wasn't until my early 20s that my body was done. You know, I was just in severe debilitating pain at that point and couldn't open my mouth more than a couple millimeters, enough to like stick a straw through, or maybe if I was feeling ambitious, shove some really soft noodles through my teeth. And it just really was feeling like I was 90 years old. So I was lucky enough to work with a TMJ specialist, a doctor who did not believe in the surgery because the outcomes are so poor. Just gotta love a doctor who pays attention to the surgical outcomes instead of just telling people to do it because it's the only thing they can say. So he was wonderful, and he was the person, actually, a conventional medical doctor who introduced me to the holistic health world, because he said to me at a certain point, you have to find some really good body work. And I genuinely did not know what that meant other than cars. And so I had to sort of research, because of how my brain works, I like to research everything that exists before I decide, call me a control freak, if you will, before I decide what to do. And when I read about Rolfing, even though it was this sort of awful word, it sounded like exactly what I needed, because I felt like I was living inside of this rusted suit of armor, and Rolfing sounded like it knew how to take that off. And sure enough, it was really a perfect match of my need, which was really long-standing significant fascial adhesions, and what it did, and also just wildly wacky alignment issues. So I got better really rapidly when I started doing my Rolfing 10 series, and it profoundly, I can't underscore enough, profoundly changed my body. I went from feeling 90, excuse me, to feeling like I could be, you know, I think I was 22 at the time, feeling like I could be 22. And so I was just, you know, desperate to be able to share that with other people and to study it, even though it wasn't, my field hadn't been anything even remotely sort of medical before that.
You know, I've heard this story before, and it never fails. Knowing you now, you know, it just never fails to amaze me, the difference. And you know, it's not two people, it's the same person. But it's just an amazing thing to know that someone can grow up with those issues and yet be as healthy and wonderful as you are. It's pretty amazing.
Thank you.
You know, for me, I found my way into this work as an adult, and I didn't see it coming at all when I was younger. So I had no idea I would be doing this work. What did you want to be when you grow up?
I was always the art girl growing up. I was always a maker. You know, I was always writing and painting and drawing. And when I was in high school, I was definitely put into the box of the arty girl, which was a box I was totally delighted to be in. But I really didn't pay attention to math or sciences. And I went on to RISD, Rhode Island School of Design. So I went to an art school where it wasn't even like I was majoring in art at a school that had everything. And RISD was, I have no regrets, it was one of the best experiences in my life, and it taught me how to be a lifelong, solid, creative thinker. So I'm always grateful for that education. But I always wanted to be an artist. And then when I had my experience with Rolfing, my logical brain said, well, if I want to help people in the healing world and I'm an artist, maybe I'll become an art therapist. You know, I was trying to like logically create a career out of meshing those things. And I applied to grad school for art therapy, and I was literally like about to go, and I just had to finally listen to the inner voice that kept saying, do you want to be a Rolfer? So be a Rolfer already. Go study anatomy and physiology. It's fine. It's okay.
I love that. Well, you know, I kind of feel similarly that, you know, well, you're an artist of the body. It's just a different approach, right? So did your artwork in school have anything to do with pain and your pain issues? Was that your...
Not in a direct way where I was, like, making paintings of jaws, you know, or anything.
Right.
But it was really interesting because it was my junior and senior year at RISD that it was my junior year that things just kind of shut down. And then I started seeing – I was seeing doctors 4 days a week. I was commuting to Boston to the Tufts Medical School because they had one of the only TMJ clinics in the country at the time that used non-surgical methods. And so my life was really filled with doctors my junior year. I was a hair away from taking a leave of absence medically, and I didn't and persevered. And then it was my senior year at RISD that I got Rolfed. And so it really is kind of interesting to look at my paintings because my junior year I was making these little tiny kind of hard paintings of little figures in these big overwhelming environments.
Right.
And then when I got Rolfed, I started making these huge, really brightly colored paintings of like really kind of solid, big people looking out at the world without
wow,
this big, overwhelming environment. So there's a little art therapist left in me, I guess, where
right.
I can still see that connection.
No, I love that. I look at my sons and my daughters, but for some reason, my son, Maury, has like all these weird obsessions. And I say, oh, you know, what would his art be? You know, when he's an adult, how is he going to manifest his kind of young craziness through his stuff. I love that.
Right, definitely.
Do you identify yourself as anything? Like, do you consider yourself a healer, or what does that mean to you? Or if people were to ask you, are you a teacher, a Rolfer, or a healer, or a guide, do you identify in one way or another?
I feel like healer is one of those words that, for me anyway, is a little presumptuous because it makes it sound like I'm the one who holds the magic wand. But I think that because of all of the things that I do in the realm, like I write my blog and I'm starting this series of books and I teach, you know, yoga tune-up or tune-up fitness and I do Rolfing, I think teacher is the word that I realize more and more that just everything I do falls under the header of just, you know, I'm just one of many kinds of teachers out there. we're educating people about this and about their options, you know.
Right. I love my chiropractor. I love my Rolfers, and I plan on seeing them forever, far into the future. You know, it's really they provide me a maintenance that I just love. But I really think that they are only one piece of the puzzle. So in terms of healing or getting fixed, how much responsibility do you think the individual has as opposed to the body worker?
Well, I think I totally agree with you. Like everyone, all of us practitioners and teachers out here are just pieces of a puzzle, and you are the puzzle maker, you know, the person who is navigating their own stuff. And so I think that you have to, you know, like I was saying before, you have to get to know yourself and get to know what you respond to well enough to be able to put together the right toolkit for you and to be able to adapt and adjust it as you adjust and change. So I think that the primary responsibility is always with the person, because nobody knows you better than you. And then we also have to realize that there are people that help. You know, we don't have to go it alone. We should be able to reach out and get the support we need and get the professionals that we need to help us.
It's great. I love the puzzle maker image. You know, in terms of health, in terms of how much people need to do on their own, how much do you advise? I'm always fascinated by, like, so let's say calling yourself a teacher or a yoga teacher, as a yoga teacher, do you tell people what to eat? Or if you're a chiropractor, should you recommend yoga and supplements? Like, within your purview, how much do you suggest other modalities? How far do you take that?
I really only take it in the realm of sending people to another practitioner or teacher or a book or a resource that I think would be helpful, as opposed to me being the one that tells them. I think that boundaries of practice matter, and I think that it's insulting to the people who've done the work. You know, so for example, Rolfing or any form of body work or movement really can bring up emotional stuff. And so I would never have the hubris to pretend that I am any good as a psychotherapist, because I'm not a psychotherapist. I haven't done that training. I have no business mucking around in that. And but if I see people who are, they came to me for the knee and it turns out to be about, you know, feelings of rage that they don't know where they're coming from, I'm delighted to continue to work with them, but we have to have a conversation about how we need another team member in this process, and that team member needs to be a therapist. And the same thing will happen if people are dealing, you know, if I have somebody who comes in because they have just this chronic low back pain, but it turns out they also have IBS and they eat McDonald's for breakfast, I know enough to be able to say, that's probably not serving you well. IBS, that chronic agitation in your intestines, can certainly irritate all the rest of the soft tissue that just snugs right up against it and irritate low back. And so I think you also need to work with a naturopath and go through an elimination diet. So I think it's important to know when to hand people other tools, but I don't pretend to be the one who can be the deliverer of all knowledge, you know, because I don't have all the knowledge.
Right. No, but it's great because you have it's amazing sometimes how people who are suffering, how little they come into the room with in terms of knowledge, and that when they find someone like you who they can trust, who you might not have all the knowledge, but you have so much, it's just I know that can be really liberating. And I feel like one of the things I offer is the simple belief that a person can change, you know, that they don't have to settle for not feeling their best. I feel sometimes like essentially I'm a cheerleader, believing in them when they have doubts. How much cheerleading, you know, is involved with what you do? Like, in a way, are you selling hope?
Cheerleading is a tough word. I'm generally not a fan of, like, straight up rah-rah. Because this is because it sounds like you're pushing something at someone, like you're trying to convince them. So I'm not trying to ever convince anyone who's not interested in hearing. But most people who show up at my doorstep, you know, once somebody's seeking out something called Rolfing that they have to pay for, and that has this weird reputation for being crazy intense, even though for those who are listening, that is not the case in terms of aggressiveness of practice. But I do think that those who show up ready to change and hoping they can change. And pain, like I know, I grew up, I had pain for a long time. Pain is just, it just shuts you down. It shuts down your life. It shuts down your hope. It makes it very hard to believe that there you could ever possibly feel any different than you feel in that moment. And I do think it's really useful for people to know that, that's possible. You know, I think it's one of the strengths of my, you know, I feel like, you know, without getting too woo-woo or too spiritual, I feel like I was really gifted in this lifetime with this experience where, and then I have a practice where I can say to people, like, look, I know you've been in agony for 5 years or 10 years or 15 years, but I, you know, I started out on day one with an injury and I grew into it for 22 years and I got better. And it's not like this, you know, and now I'm a perfect human being who's never affected by it. It's not like that, but I'm radically different than that person. And so I do think that it's helpful for people to know people do get better. And I think we live, you know, in a culture where we're doing things, we're eating things, and we're moving in ways that make chronic pain a norm. And I think that it's, you know, definitely one of my missions. Hopefully I'll be able to succeed in it to let people know that chronic pain should not be a norm. So in that sense, I guess I am selling hope, or at least options, you know, showing people the options and opportunities.
How often do you use, like, your own story? You know, I know that as, you know, it's like same thing about Rolfing. I teach people to walk, you know, and what a concept. Sometimes, you know, that people say, what do you do? And I say, I teach people to walk, and they look at me cross-eyed like, what are you talking about? I know how to walk. I've been doing it forever. And I will literally talk about my story in terms of what led me to walking. How often do you, and your story is so much more even specific to chronic pain, how often do you use your own backstory? Do you do that?
I certainly don't lead with it, like I don't, but a lot of people people want to know. That's okay. These things happen. A lot of people want to know, you know, they want to hear why I do what I do. You know, it's not like I went to law school or became an accountant or something. That's just like a part of our conventional choices. And then a lot of people are looking for hope too. And I do have it on my website. And I know for sure through the years that a lot of people, you know, my private practice website, that a lot of people have come to see me because they feel like I get it. You know, I understand chronic pain and how debilitating it can be. And also I got better. And so maybe I know something about getting better. So I wouldn't say that, it's sort of handed out to anyone who I ever meet or ever come across. And sometimes I'm surprised because I feel like I do say it so much that a good friend or maybe a client who I've seen for 5 years or 10 years in my practice will, you know, say like, oh, I didn't even know you. Oh, you grew up with pain. And I'm like, oh, really? You haven't heard this story?
Yeah, right.
I'm saying this story all the time, but okay. So, yeah.
It's interesting as you're, how long have you been teaching yoga?
I teach, and I just want to specify because I think it's important because a lot of people come into Yoga Tune-Up who are already yoga teachers. They've done their 200 or 500 hour or whatever, but I'm a Yoga Tune-Up teacher, and I think of myself as like a tune-up teacher, which is more, to my mind, and Jill will be on this conference, but a form of corrective exercise and self-myofascial release that was born out of yoga. So I just want to clarify because when people say you're a yoga teacher, I'm always a little uncomfortable with it because I'm a yoga tune-up teacher.
So that's great. So I didn't realize that in a way. Do you teach group classes?
I do. I teach group classes of yoga tune-up.
Great.
Which is, you know, its own particular form of yoga, but I wouldn't be, you know, subbing for someone's vinyasa class or something just because
totally
I don't have
that.
That training.
And,
yeah.
And that's been a couple of years now, right?
Yeah, it's been a couple of years. I'm trying to think. Well, is it 2 years in April? Yeah, it'll be 2 years in April. So coming up on that.
That's pretty great. So you've been Rolfing for 15, is that about right?
It's 13, going on 14, yeah.
Oh, that's pretty great. So, are you now combining the two? Do you like see people for Rolfing only? Do you, when you get Rolfing people, do you start encouraging them to start looking elsewhere. Or another way of looking at it is when you're helping people with pain, are you trying to use one thing or the other or both, or what?
It wind up being a combo platter a lot of the time, and it's the reason why I studied yoga tune-up is because I had been a practitioner for a long time where the person comes to see me and they lay on the table or sit on the table and I work on them with my hands and then they go back to their life. And it was frustrating for me because the reason why they're seeing me is usually because they have poor movement patterning. Whether they had an accident or an injury or not, whether the poor movement patterning was the chicken or the egg, it's the issue. And I also just felt like I didn't want to be the kind of keeper of them getting better. I wanted to give them some way to work on themselves. So mostly my practice is still people coming to see me for rolfing, but every session always has some yoga tune-up in it, whether I'm showing them how to work on the therapy balls or showing them movement work. And then a lot of people will do one or two just total, you know, yoga tune-up privates with me if they're doing a rolfing series, so that they can also have this kind of protocol that they that's individualized to whatever their structural needs are that they can take home and use and feel empowered, like they can work on themselves and not always have to be reliant on me.
No, that's great. I think that's just in our world the most important thing, you know, in that, and that was a lot of my drive to create this project is just how many people I come across that really want to be fixed as opposed to working with me to fix themselves, and the process of getting them on the on that treadmill of their own to start doing the doing the work with me. You know, when you kind of touched on pain being your impetus to do this, if you want to touch again on like the value of pain and how do you deal with, help your clients deal with their pain, or in terms of how they can release it?
You mean like what do I literally do in my practice, or how are we kind of talking about the possibility of not being in pain?
Talking about the possibility, like the literal, the physical is clear, right? So more about how do
you... Right.
Yeah,
I mean, again, I think that I'm fortunate in that when people, you know, Rolfing has gotten this, well, on the one hand, it has this reputation for being, like people put it in the aggressive massage basket, which is really not where it belongs, unfortunately.
Right.
It's really slow, patient work. It's depthful work, but very patient, or should be in the hands of somebody who is doing it appropriately. But it also has this reputation for actually helping people who are at the end of their rope. So I wind up getting a lot of people who are fed up and just like, I'll try anything. I guess I'll try this, you know. And usually a lot of people, you know, I say to my friends a lot of times that I'm a big fan of rock bottom. Maybe I shouldn't say these things, but I do think that there's something about when you run out of options that you're like, you're faced with that moment where you're either going to succumb to it or you're going to say, that is it. I am working this out. I'm finding a way out of this. And so I get a lot of those people. And so they are ready to, more often than not, do the work and know that there are options and show up for that. And, you know, many years ago when I was first starting out in my practice, I had the genius idea to move from Boston, where I had friends and family and work and colleagues, and moved to Napa, California, where I had nothing, no job, no friends, no car, because I was 25 or something, and that's what you do when you're 25, and that I would start my first rolfing practice, and it would be great. And so I worked with a holistic MD who had, you know, a bunch of things, a lot of nutritional stuff. She was also a dietitian, but she also had a lot of pain patients who were on workman's comp. And I'll never forget a day where I was, you know, so there's a lot of people, workman's comp was paying for them to come and see me, and I was just supposed to kind of hammer away at one area, which is not the rolfer thing, and it makes me nuts.
Right.
Like, if your shoulder hurts, I'm only supposed to touch your shoulder, because workman's comp says I'm only allowed to touch your shoulder. It makes me insane. So it was killing my soul in that way, because I'm like, this doesn't make any sense.
Right.
There's no way I'm just touching this person's shoulder. But then I also had this person, I'll never forget this moment, who was seeing me for, I think it was carpal, yeah, it was carpal tunnel pain. And so I'm working around her elbow, and she pulls out a Game Boy and totally ignores me and starts playing on the Game Boy and looking at the Game Boy as I'm working on her elbow for carpal tunnel. And I'm trying to have a conversation about how, you know, really if she could pay attention to me, she's like, oh, it's fine, just, you know, work on the elbow. And I was just like, that's it. I only want to work with people who are ready for the hallelujah moment. I don't want to work on the people who are like, just shut up and fix me. I'm going to be over here doing the thing that harmed me in the first place. So I'm fortunate in that way that that's what my practice mostly consists of. It makes it a lot easier to communicate with people when they're ready to hear.
Yeah, it's, you know, I say sometimes in my yoga classes, I don't use that phrase, but basically I'll be like, you know, you don't have to have the hallelujah moment. You can, you don't have to heal. You can go and you can do anything you want. You can go through life exactly as you are. You know, it's that's so much of it for me is, and you can't create the hallelujah moment for somebody. You can't make them see the need to change, even though they're coming to you for exactly that. You know, like I feel in a lot of ways I'm a detective in what I do. I'm really trying to. I look at people come in and they don't. I have to figure out what the root of what their problem is. And sometimes for me that I find it way back, you know, like in terms of a brain injury at birth or even a car accident when they were five, like how much detective work do you feel like you do in your practice?
It's actually, that's exactly the word that I describe for what I do. I say I do detective work. That's my whole job. And it's not like it's important for me to figure out the reason, because oftentimes it's impossible to figure out the reason, but you know, like, oh, it's because, you know, your right side is tight because your parents always put on your diapers too tight on the right side. You know, I don't know, like these little quirky things that happen to us in our lives. So I don't need to point out the actual reason, but what I'm a detective of is the pattern, you know, and what is the sort of broader compensatory pattern in the tissue, and how does it respond, and where does it go, and where does it not respond, and how does it shift and change? So I feel like I'm always kind of tracking that, and that's my job. That's what I do for a living, if people ask me.
No, I love that. I mean, I feel like we're very similar in that way.
Yeah.
you know, and for me personally, I love getting worked on. I'll go to anybody. You know, I like, I meet somebody, I just want to check out what they do, you know, and I went to a healer recently, and I told her she was working on me, and she was doing just some really interesting energy work, and I told her I thought I was pretty good at not carrying the burden of others, you know, in my work, and she just laughed and told me I was wrong. So I thought I was like, really? Okay. How do you relate to that? Like, do you take on the suffering of others in your work? What does that look like for you? Like, how do you protect yourself from taking on too much?
I certainly try not to, though I definitely feel like those of us who choose these things as professions, who want to heal other people's pain, are kind of inclined towards thinking that we can and we should, and, you know, I think we're a certain slice of personality types. I definitely fall into that basket, but I do think that, you know, I had an experience, speaking of being a fan of Rock Bottom, when I finished college and I had had my Rolfing experience and I was applying to grad school to be an art therapist, I was working in a home for adults with dual diagnosis, developmental disabilities and mental illness, as a case manager. And it was kind of my way of being like, well, what are environments like where art therapy can be really useful? And I did that for 2 years. And I, at that time in my life, was, I mean, I'm still totally codependent. I'm working on it. But back then I was like wildly codependent. And I picked a job where it was my job to literally, you know, dedicate my life to other people's suffering, you know, be in the hospital with someone until 4 a.m. because they're having grand mal seizures or whatever. I knew the paramedics in that neighborhood by first name. We all knew each other really well, and that was my job, and it just shredded me. You know, I spent 2 years there, and I crashed because I would go home, and I would think about my clients. And I would worry about my clients. And so I think I learned the hard way that I have to find a way to have cleaner and healthier boundaries. And I would say that at this point, you know, it's not that I don't still notice in myself that wish someone will come to me with significant pain that they've had for a long time. And of course, there's that part of me that goes, I really hope I can get them better. You know, I really hope that they can get out of pain. And I see that attachment in myself, but I definitely don't, you know, go home feeling burdened with other people's pain because it's not my job. Spiritual practice helps a lot with this too. It's just learning that, you know, my job is me and their job is them, and we meet up in this place where we get to work together, and then we, you know, go back to our lives. But yeah, it's funny that she said that to you, because I'm sure that I would say that too. Like, oh, I'm really pretty good at not taking on people's suffering. It's a process, but it's significantly better than it used to be.
Right. You know, I literally take it for granted that I'm fairly detached, and I didn't. But when she said it, I was like, oh, how could I not? You know, it's just kind of part of the process. You know, I worked in a hospital for a while, and one of the things I did notice was that a lot of caregivers get sick, a lot of caregivers, a lot of nurses with autoimmune issues, and it's just kind of rampant in the business, and a lot of healing professionals have a tendency to take care of, not to take care of themselves because they're so focused on others. Is that, do you find it easier to help others than yourself in that context?
I feel like I have come to a place of balance where I realize how important it is to take care of myself, and I value myself more now than I did when I was younger. You know, that learning about worthiness stuff that some of us healing martyr types have. and I feel like I've just come to a place where I realize that I can't, I don't have the magic wand. It's not me that's making a person better. So it's important for me to take care of myself and have those boundaries.
This goes back to something you just said a minute or two ago, but I think one of the things that not everybody, but for a lot of us, and what motivates us is seeing, you know, growth and change in our client. It's what we hope for them. But what do you expect of your clients, or how attached are you to their success?
I mostly would say that I'm not particularly attached to their success, except for what I can't help but notice in myself, which is, and especially because I'm somebody who dealt with pain for a long time, I just really want to see people be pain-free. And whether I'm the person who makes that happen or their acupuncturist or anybody else does, I would love to see more of the world be pain-free. And I do have a detachment to that, obviously, because that's what I've dedicated my career to. I don't feel like I can be the one to make the magic happen or to fully deliver that to people. Does that make sense?
Totally, absolutely. I mean, like, do you feel, do you have a responsibility to motivate people? Like, I find that there's kind of a fine line between enabling and guiding and figuring out the difference.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it comes back to, do people want to hear it, and do people want to do their own work or not? Because as soon as it's me trying to convince somebody who really does not want to be convinced or really has already decided that there is no hope, then I'm just enabling, and it's exhausting. It's exhausting for me. It's exhausting for them. And it's like you said, you know, people get to, you can do whatever you want. Like, you don't have to have a hallelujah moment. You don't have to get better. It's all just whatever you choose, and it has nothing to do with me. Except for the fact that you hired me, you know, to use a gauche term, but you hired me to try and help you work on this. But honestly, I have people sometimes who, it doesn't happen that much just because I tend to attract people to my practice who really want to get better. But of course, there are the people who show up sometimes who just kind of want to be there so that they can prove that nothing really, I tried everything, so that's proof that nothing really will help. And they're really negative, and they're really, and they're kind of antagonistic with me, like, oh, well, tell me how, blah, blah, blah. And I just, it's just not my job. And, you know, usually I'll have a compassionate but somewhat direct conversation with them about that I'm not going to be you know, working to entice them into the idea that there's a better day ahead, because they don't need to want a better day. It's none of my business.
No, it's a trip. And so you don't find that you want to, like, sometimes win those battles? I mean, have you ever just said no to anybody, or just said, look, you're just not doing it, so there's no point in coming back?
I have said no to people, not necessarily because they weren't, like, doing their homework, so to speak.
Right.
But because they were just so convinced, so fatalistic. And so the conversation is usually just something like, you say that you're not getting any better. You're not doing the work at home. You seem to believe that, you know, this is just the way it's going to go for you. So why come? You know,
right.
Why keep coming? And I'm delighted to give you the names of other people, colleagues of mine who I know who've helped others, if you're interested in trying that. And you don't have to be interested in trying that. So I do think it's important to just realize when somebody's working with you, not because they want to get better, but because they want to prove
right. That
there's no hope.
That's such a trip. And I never really think of it that way, but I think that there's probably a very large layer of that in people and just how they process what they're going through. Like, what kind of healers have you sought in your life? What motivated you when you feel unable to do the work? You know, like, what would you say the major changes you've had to make in order to be on your path?
Well, I'm like you. I like to get work from everyone. But I have some key people who I get work from. You know, there's a PT who lives near me who practices much more like a osteopath, and, you know, manipulative cranial osteopath. And I see her, and I see my colleague in my practice, Rachel Felsen, and she does a lot of the more kind of nerve glide work in Rolfing that I don't do and that I think is tremendously effective, and I love that. And I'm craniosacral, and I'm a huge advocate of traditional Chinese medicine, and obviously I do, you know, yoga tune-up. So I do a lot of stuff, and I do think that there's this balance between making sure I do my work and making sure that I'm at home working on my own body. And by working on my own body, I don't always mean, like, taking time out to, you know, work on my lats, sticky lats or whatever, although I certainly have those moments, but also just setting up my life in a way that I think is nourishing, where I'm not, you know, sitting on my couch on my laptop in a C curve or, you know, things like that.
My favorite.
Yes, right, I know. So trying to make sure that I set myself up that way. But I do think that it's important to partner with other practitioners and get their perspective on your body. Like, I'm always learning fresh stuff about my body. Like, I have an Alexander teacher in town who I work with, Rachel Burnson, and I just love going to see her because I think that I'm doing all my work, and I am, and I have this great, healthy, happy body, and yet I can just go see her for a session, and I'm like, holy crap, like, I'm gripping in my body, like, I'm such a gripper, and I just learn something new when I get this outside perspective. So we need to get to know ourselves, and we also need to know ourselves well enough to realize that we're always going to have blind spots. And that's where other people come in handy.
You know, it's, for me, so much of, again, you know, teaching to people to walk is somewhat amorphous. And a lot of what I'm trying to help people with is trusting themselves, you know. And is there a rule book for managing that line between, you know, trusting yourself and believing your healers and developing a genuine relationship with your own instincts? Like, what do you do when your gut tells you something different than your healer does? You know, do you,
Well, I think our guts matter. You know, I do think that. And I think that getting, you know, other perspectives is really useful if you're getting some work and you just feel like that's not the whole truth of it. Like, I recently had some, you know, health stuff going on over the past year where I was having all this weird stuff going on with my energy and weird liver result tests, and I don't drink any alcohol or use any drugs, so it was like really bizarre. I don't even take like Motrin or Advil. And then I also was in premature ovarian failure, so I was in menopause, and I was like, this is crazy at 38. And I kept doing all the testing, and I was working with practitioners who I love and adore. And I kept thinking, this has got to have something to do with my thyroid. I have every symptom of thyroids, but my blood test keeps saying my thyroid is fine. But my gut kept saying, the thyroid has to be the thing that's leading the charge here, because that's the only thing that makes sense. And so I listened to my gut, and I went back to my naturopath again, and I said, look, can we just do a more, you know, comprehensive test? And again, my thyroid levels look pretty much fine, but my T3 was just a whiff low. And he's like, well, you know, it might be a whiff low for most people, but really low for you, because these aren't subtle thyroid symptoms. And so we started supplementing, and everything changed. Literally,
wow,
every symptom went away. And so I think that we need to know ourselves well enough to know when to persevere. But it was still in partnership with him,
right,
and, you know, with my other care providers, where I found the way, because I wouldn't have known what supplementation to use, or that it was T3 versus TSH and what that means. And so I think that it's always a balance between listening to ourselves and then also finding good care providers.
Well, that's a very cool thing, in that you actually were listening to yourself, and you had the right answer, but you still didn't have the right solution, that you still needed help. Even though your gut was telling,
yeah,
you the right thing, you still wouldn't have known where to go. I think that's really great.
Yeah.
It's interesting for me in that there's, you know, this, our standard Western model, that the medical model, that doesn't always include other healing modalities. But even though I like working with alternative practitioners and stuff, sometimes I have to go to traditional medical doctors and use their tools, and sometimes even recommend them to my clients. You know, what's your relationship to allopathic medicine in your life and practice?
Yeah, I mean, I have no hatred, really, or distaste for allopathic medicine. I just think that it happens to be really, really good at certain things and not particularly good at other things. And I would prefer that the field in general would acknowledge that and say, we're great at managing disease processes, and we're great at dealing with trauma, and we're great at keeping people alive or helping people turn things around when things are already really pretty broken. But I think that, you know, unfortunately, there's this idea that it's good at everything. So that's my only hang up about it. I definitely, you know, recommend it to people. One of my dearest friends are doctors. That's always that caveat you have to say. I have friends who are doctors, but I do. And I respect and admire their work, and I think they practice in wonderful ways. And more I am seeing this partnership. I'm sure partially it's the circles that I hang out in, but people who are willing to say, like, oh, you know, maybe you should, you're dealing with, you know, infertility, maybe you should go talk to this acupuncturist or whatever the issue is. And in my case with chronic pain stuff, I do think that orthopedic medicine, because that's the sort of branch of medicine that I wind up interacting with the most, because that's who my people are, they're seeing their orthopedist person and me. I think that it has reduced itself in an unfortunate way to drugs and surgery, and I'm really not delighted by the amount of narcotic painkillers that people are just fed, and I'm really not delighted by the surgeries that are being done, even when the data says that they're not particularly effective. That makes me unhappy.
Right.
And that they're not looking at basics of human movement and how that might be contributing to the dramatic rise in knee replacements and things like that. But there are people who I will see, you know, like I had somebody come in, this was many years ago, but he scheduled a walking appointment and said, I'm having this really severe pain. He comes into my office, new person, never met him before, and he has his arm up in the air. He can't move his arm down without severe pain. He's like this kind of big, tough guy personality, but I can see that he's white and sweating. And he says to me, I need a Rolfing session. This just showed up out of the blue the other day. No, you do not need a Rolfing session. You know, probably you're having a really significant disc impingement, or possibly even a disc rupture, and you need to go immediately to see a good orthopedist. And it turned out he had ruptured a cervical disc, and he needed emergency orthopedic surgery.
Wow.
And that did the thing. So I know my place. Like, I'm not going to Rolf away somebody's ruptured cervical disc and where they can't breathe from the pain. I'm not their person in that moment. So I do need to know what I help with and what I don't help with and when surgery, or an orthopedist in general, just to, you know, confer with, is useful and important and meaningful.
Yeah, that's great. There's a very interesting thing, and I think there's a slight difference between people like you and I and alternative workers, in that I say to people, you should totally go to the orthopedist, but don't forget that his job is to do surgery. Like,
right.
You know, he, in orthopedic, you know, go for someone with knee pain, which is my background, you know, knee surgeries. They have three things to say. They're either going to say, you're fine, go to physical therapy, or get surgery. And
right.
I think that's fine. That is absolutely their job. But I find that the alternative caregivers tend to have a larger view, you know.
Yeah.
A more dynamic view that might suggest going different directions to try to heal. The surgeries that don't work is an amazing thing for me, just on a simple level of, you know, there are statistics. So anyone who's going to go for a particular surgery, you know, hip replacement surgeries are an unbelievably successful surgery,
mm-hmm.
while bunion surgeries are just not as
right.
successful, you know, and that, but people don't always take those kind of simple little ideas into account when they're just making their decisions.
I know, and it makes me mad, quite frankly. I'm not supposed to be practicing data-driven medicine. Look at the data.
Yeah, exactly right. All right, so, like, as a takeaway, what do you think would be the most important first steps for somebody who wants to get on the road to being their own healer?
I think that we have to get to know ourselves in our lives. And I think that no matter how well I think I know myself, I'm always surprised by some corner I turn. And I don't mean this just in the physical body sense, though I do mean it that way, but I just mean in general. And I think that that is what opens up pathways to knowing how to navigate what is ever going to be most useful for us in that moment. And so that is things like a mindfulness or meditation practice or a spiritual practice, if you're oriented that way, and a movement practice where you can go inside and constantly be asking the question, how is this working for me? You know, how does this feel for my body? What am I learning about my body as I do this? And maybe therapy, I don't know, you know, but I do think that all of these things lead to self-knowledge being really the way to go. And then I think that it makes it a lot easier when we get to know ourselves and get friendly with ourselves and get friendly with our own peculiar realities, that it makes it easier to find who's going to help you and what's going to help you and how to walk that path.
It's great. There's one of my favorite quotes is the German writer Goethe said, know myself. If I knew myself, I'd run and hide.
Exactly. And then you find the run and hide moment, and instead you look at it. And that's what we're all up to, I think.
Yeah, totally. Well, thank you so much, Brooke. It was really great talking to you and getting your perspective on the health and healing. You know, you have so much to offer people, and seeking more awareness of their body and freedom from pain. And, you know, as healers, we often work alone, but I have so valued the connections I've made with others, and especially you. You know, it's been a lot of years, and we provide a lot of support for each other, which I think is really amazing.
Yeah,
and for those of you who want to know more about Brooke, you should and can totally visit her website, fasciafreedomfighters.com, and absolutely
mm-hmm.
download her essential book, Why Fascia Matters. It's a really great book. Links are on the website at beyourownhealer.net, and please support Brooke and check out what she's got to offer. Thanks for listening. Thanks,
Thank
Brooke.
You.
Have a great day.
You too.